Well, this talk is basically looking at the experience of the Rudd government. Of course, we have an election coming up this year, most likely October or November. So it's worthwhile having a little bit of an overview about the experience of Labour in government. After all, prior to that, we had, 12 years or thereabouts of Liberal government. With the Liberal government associated a series of horrific things like the so-called Pacific Solution, sinking refugees at sea, the attacks in Iraq and Afghanistan, the homophobic measures, banning gay marriage, particularly the anti-working class measures to do with work choices, user pays in public services, and a range of crackdowns on civil rights at home, the targeting of Muslims. I guess most people over about the age of 17 or 18 have some memory about the nasty nature of the Howard government. And perhaps John Pilger notwithstanding, in November 2007, when the Howard government was done, I guess people had not rapturously high expectations of the Rudd government, but at least some faint hope that things might change here and there. Well, I think you have to say nearly 2.5 years after the Rudd government won office, the signs are of anything that Rudd has continued basically the main thrust of the Howard agenda. Now, if we're to be quite candid and to be quite realistic, we would have to say that this should not really have been a surprise. Because when you look at Rudd's history and Labour Party's history in the run-up to the 2007 election, it was quite clear, really, what the nature of this incoming government was going to be. Its election platform at the 2007 election was probably the most right-wing, anti-working-class, anti-union platform in relation to workers' rights and industrial relations. In his first press conference as leader, when he dumped Beazley in December 2006, Rudd emphasised the three pillars of his leadership: mainstream and conservative economics, rock-solid adherence to the US alliance, and a hard-line stance, quote, on national security. But none of this was new either in relation to Rudd. Rudd had long made his name in the Labour circles as being a right-winger. He'd written in the Financial Review in 2001 about his ambition to dump the socialisation objective of the Labour Party, which is a faint echo of Labour's radical period after the First World War, emphasising all the time the need for a reward for individual efforts, for equality of opportunity, which is kind of a liberal code word for capitalism. And he was also one of the most ardently pro-American of all senior Labour politicians, reproducing all the lies in the run-up to the Iraq War of 2003 about Saddam Hussein's supposed possession of weapons of mass destruction. Business leaders were pretty calm and confident about Rudd as well. Rudd's first overseas visit as party leader was to New York, where he met Rupert Murdoch, who declared that the new Labour leader would, quote, make a good prime minister, with friends like that. What Rudd Labour offered the ruling class was a way of continuing the Howard reform agenda, quote, but without some of the social and political polarisation that went with it. Rudd Labour could keep the guts of work choices intact and calm down the trade union movement. Now, Rudd sought to give himself something of a progressive veneer, understanding the fact that what people wanted was turning the page on the Howard agenda. In a piece in the Monthly magazine, before he got elected as leader, he quoted the works of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was an anti-Nazi Lutheran priest in Germany in the 1930s, and Rudd talked about his desire to stand up for the marginalised and the oppressed, and his tradition of Christian compassion. On his first press conference as leader, he maintained that he was after an alternative, not an echo, as an implicit criticism of the Beazley Labour leadership, which essentially had been to yap behind the tail of John Howard. However, the Melbourne Herald Sun got it right, 7 months before, in fact, Labour was elected, when it said this: "By out-Howarding Howard, Rudd can slot into Howard's job and go on as things were before the PM got too smart with work choices and the war in Iraq. Despite promising on his elevation to Labour leadership to be, quote, an alternative, not an echo, there is not a sliver of difference between the government and opposition on many key issues." Now, this has proven to be perfectly correct. A small glimmer of truth that crept into the Herald Sun. Because when you look at the Rudd government in office, you can see that the Herald Sun's judgment was quite realistic. From the outset, just as Rudd promised, he tried to position his government as being one of fiscal conservatism. So shortly after Labour's first budget in May 2008, Rudd boasted to the Victorian Labour Conference that, quote, "As a share of national output, We've reduced government spending to its lowest level since 1989, not coincidentally when Labor was last in office. And tax as a proportion of national output has also been reduced. Delegates, Rudd said, what the budget demonstrated is that the Australian Labor Party is now unmistakably the party of responsible economic management. According to Melbourne Herald Sun, true once again, Wayne Swan's first budget looks like being the one Peter Costello always wanted to deliver. Now, with the crash in the world financial system in September 2008, all his promises of fiscal conservatism went for a period out of the window. The Rudd government spent billions of dollars underwriting bank deposits, unleashed stimulus packages of $52 billion, and in the face of the biggest crisis in the world economy since the Great Depression, ramped up a series of populist appeals. The monthly magazine basically gave him regular occasions to hold forth. He wrote that the problem is extreme capitalism and unrestrained greed that has perverted so much of the global financial system. And he pointed the finger at what he called the activities of predatory speculators. The solution, however, of course, was not socialism, but a more regulated, gentler form of capitalism. Now, after a scare in the months after the major Wall Street meltdown in late 2008, by the middle of 2009, the Australian economy was beginning to recover. Now, when measured in per capita terms, adjusting for the size of the population, GDP actually fell by 1.5% in the year to September. Yet taken as a whole, it was actually the most successful of all the OECD economies. Unemployment peaked at less than 6%, and for those who kept their job and kept full-time hours, the situation is relatively benign. A combination of cash handouts, lower petrol prices, lower mortgage interest rates meant the household disposable income rose by 9%. Now this, however, was only a temporary hiatus. By the latter half of 2009, interest rates were on their way back up again. Rising house prices continued to make it almost impossible for anyone not born to a rich family to buy a home in their 20s or 30s. And if the government had lurched away from some of the main tenets of neoliberalism at the heart of the crisis, this was only a short-term manoeuvre to save capitalism from the abyss. And so by July 2009, not 9 months after lambasting the free market liberals for their obsession with budget surpluses, Rudd was back in the Sydney Morning Herald promising very soon a surplus budget which would involve difficult and unpopular cuts and that the economic recovery would involve a squeeze in working class living standards. Just to reinforce this point, his treasurer, Wayne Swan, said in February this year, telling the National Press Club of his intention to swing the axe on spending to improve the sustainability of government finances over the medium term. In other words, after a short, sustained burst of government largesse, we're back to gruel and sacrifice. Meanwhile, those who contributed to the crisis got off scot-free. At the height of the crisis, Rudd had actually commissioned the Productivity Commission to start an investigation into CEO pay packages, responding to a popular mood of disgust towards those who headed big business and helped to create the crisis. When the Commission reported, however, in January 2010, the immediate crisis over, surprise, surprise, no measures whatsoever to restrain CEO salaries. Australian banks did their bit to make life difficult for ordinary people by raising interest rates by more than the central bank rate was pushed up in 2009 into 2010. The Prime Minister and Treasurer Wayne Swan admonished them, but then did nothing whatsoever to force them to cut rates. Prominent union leader and ALP member John Sutton from the CFMU wrote in the Sydney Morning Herald in early January that Kevin Rudd's grand treatise on the failures of capitalism a few months into the global financial crisis is ending up with a whimper rather than a roar. Despite the effects of the GFC, tough talk of regulatory reform now looks like empty promises. But there was more to it than just budget surpluses. In the 1980s, the Labor Party had established itself as a party of privatisation. Many of those enterprises that had not been sold off by the Hawke and Keating government were then sold off by Howard. Labor, on coming to office in 2007, even at the height of the financial crisis, took not one step to renationalise any of the privatised public assets. Instead, it continued the same Howard agenda of privatisation and public-private partnerships, spending $43 billion on a new national broadband network, only to sell it off in 5 years' time. ride back the effort by the Emma government in New South Wales to sell off the state's electricity generation industry, and also backs Anna Bligh's privatisation package in Queensland. We can see the same obsession with market solutions and subsidies to big business in the area of global warming. Ryder declared global warming the, quote, the great moral challenge of our time. In December 2008, this is fully a year after Ryder was elected to office, the government released a white paper outlining its emissions trading scheme. Now, it has to be said that the whole notion of an emissions trading scheme is basically putting big business in charge of solving the problems created by big business. It itself can never be a solution. It's using the market to try and solve the problems that the market created. But nonetheless, even within those parameters, it was a disgustingly rotten emissions trading scheme, promising to cut emissions by only 5% by 2020, far below the figure recommended by such authorities as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It was not just that the targets were measly. Built on the very notion of an emissions trading scheme is big subsidies, big business. And Australia, with its heavy emphasis on fossil fuels, of course, was going to be, the government was going to be offering huge subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. There were some crumbs of compensation offered to working class households, but inadequate to meet the rise in fuel and household costs associated with the ETS. It was only with the implosion within the Liberal Party and a takeover by Malcolm Turnbull that Rudd's rotten emissions trading scheme was finally buried. And it has to be said, far better that it was buried than it actually passed as such an appallingly reactionary, financially regressive, environmentally flawed scheme. The Rudd government has been notorious for its coddling of the rich and squeezing of the poor. Labour's much vaunted responsible economic management was only meant to apply to workers and students. The wealthy were to be coddled just as they had been under Howard. So Rudd delivered in full the regressive income tax cuts that the Howard government had offered as part of its electoral sweetener. Corporate taxes, which stood at 49% in the first year of the Labor government of 1983 under Bob Hawke, have been reduced both through Labor governments and the Howard government to 30% 19 years later, and were to stay at 30% under the Rudd government. Tax breaks for investors were maintained in full. The government did promise to raise the age pension to 27.5% up from 25% of average weekly earnings, but at the same time announced for the first time in Australian history a lift in the retirement age from 65 to 67. Meanwhile, those who had accumulated large superannuation accounts are disproportionately middle class and upper class males continue to enjoy fantastic tax advantages such as tax-free super from the age of 60, subsidised out of the public purse. The Rudd government has continued Howard's squeeze on university students. Average class sizes rose under Labor and Liberal governments between 1990 and 2007 by 60%. University salaries fell in relation to their similar industries. None of this was fundamentally challenged by the Rudd government. The Rudd government has increased university spending, but it's still only, relative to GDP, three-quarters of the OECD average. When you bear in mind the relative wealth of Australia, the fact it's 25% below the OECD average, which includes Portugal and Greece and other poorer countries, tells you how stingy Australian funding is for the university system. The Rudd government also maintained a squeeze on university students in relation to youth allowance, and particularly to stop students protesting against this, to maintain the ban on universal student unionism, which was introduced by the Labor government in about 2004. But he didn't just focus his fire on the university students. The private school system was bailed out enormously. The government continued the Howard government's massive handouts to the already privileged private schools. The Scotch colleges and the Shores will continue to dip into the public purse to pay for their rifle ranges, their manicured lawns, while public schools in the working class areas suffer from a lack of basic school infrastructure. Private health insurance, a total rot for the middle class and upper class, which basically diverts billions of dollars away from the public health system. The private health insurance rebate, which basically offers people 30% of the cost of private health insurance, is to be maintained. Means tested, perhaps, but nonetheless overlooking the essential thing, which is the whole scheme needs to be scrapped, and all the money that's basically given to people to subsidise the private health insurance industry needs to be diverted back into the public health sector. Rudd recently announced his so-called federal takeover of the hospital system, subject to the agreement of the states. This is just smoke and mirrors. no real extra funding is going to be diverted to the public health system, which will continue to creak under the strain of financial austerity. The right agenda is particularly clear in the area of work choices and industrial relations. Socialist Alternative very quickly, along with some other left-wing unionists, dubbed the industrial relations package released by Labour in the middle of 2007 as work choices light. And in that sense, Rudd and Gillard are at the forefront, have promoted exactly work choices light in office. Dave Noonan, who's the CFMEU, that's construction industry, national secretary, told 2009 ACTU Congress delegates in relation to the threatened jailing of an Adelaide construction worker by the name of Ark Tribe. He said, "It is a shameful reflection on this Labor government that ordinary construction workers now face the possibility of 6 months imprisonment because the government has not removed the most extreme laws left behind by John Howard." Ark Tribe's day of reckoning comes in June when his court case comes up in Adelaide. Julia Gillard from the left, it should be said, of the Labor Party, has been maintaining not just the ABCC, but also putting on the size of 10 or 11 boots to kick trade unionists whenever they object to the continuation of work choices light. At the ACTU Congress in 2009, in response to the criticisms of Labor for maintaining the ABCC, Julia Gillard basically went up and gave them the middle finger, launching an anti-union diatribe against workers fighting for their rights on the Westgate Bridge here in Melbourne. It was not just the ABCC. Labor maintained Howard's so-called Fair Pay Commission, chaired by a religious right-wing nutbag economics professor from Melbourne University by the name of Ian Harper. He continued the gig for two full more years after Labor was elected, including handing down a 0%, not a zero pay increase for low-paid workers at the height of the global depression. Some months later, Gillard was to boast that Labor's industrial relations laws had resulted in the lowest rate of increase in private sector wages since records were collected in 1998. Labor's harmonisation of occupational health and safety laws across the states has resulted in a race to the bottom in trashing working class safety standards on jobs. Their award modernisation process, the idea being trying to simplify, when have you heard a government talk about simplifying reform? You know you're in trouble. Simplification of the award system has, of course, led to a gutting of the better paid awards in favour of the lower paid awards. Now, it has to be said that Labor has been able to get away with all this because of the uncritical support and fawning from the ACTU. ACTU Secretary Jeff Lawrence described Labor's Fair Work Bill as, quote, major steps forward for Australian workers, and refuses to put any pressure on Labor to improve its industrial relations laws. In some ways, Tony Abbott is a godsend for the ACTU, because it enables them to step back from even the tiny, tiny criticisms they were making of Labor's package to focus their fire on the Liberals and basically allow the Labor Party to get away with a continuation of work choices. Now, that's in relation just to economic, workers' rights generally. I want to focus now just specifically on the rights of the oppressed. I'm going to start about the rights particularly on women. Labor is going to introduce a parental leave scheme. Good, about bloody time. Australia is the only other country in the OECD, I believe, which is the United States, does not have a paid parental leave scheme. So Labor is going to introduce one. But it's going to be means tested and set at the minimum wage, I think about $540 a week. The scheme not only is one of the last to be introduced in the OECD, but is also one of the meanest in terms of the payment. And when Tony Abbott, the Liberal leader, proposed an actually far more generous scheme to be funded by, shock horror, a 1.7% tax on business, Labor attacked Abbott from the right for having the temerity to suggest that business might be taxed to provide for parental leave. Gay and lesbian people have been smacked over the head by the Rudd government as well. Labor had supported John Howard's ban on gay marriage, same-sex marriage, in 2004. And although the Rudd government has lifted some discriminatory provisions from a series of laws and superannuation and social security and so forth, nonetheless it maintains the ban on same-sex marriage, even as Labor conferences in Tasmania and Victoria vote in favour of lifting it. Now, often when it comes to questions like abortion, same-sex rights and so forth, reform parties like Labor often try to hide behind the cover of public opinion. We can't get too far ahead of public opinion, they say. Otherwise, we'll suffer electorally. Well, the fact is that public opinion supports same-sex marriage by 60%. by 74% amongst young people and by well over 60% amongst Labour supporters. And yet Rudd will still not introduce this most basic civil right for LGBTI citizens. Aboriginal policy. I think the relatively small size of this meeting today tells you a lot of interest and anger that's been aroused by Labour government policy towards Aborigines. Elsewhere in this building, Richard Downes is holding forth about the disgusting nature of the Northern Territory intervention. But Labour actually started with a bit of a tick in the eyes of many people when in February 2008, the very first sitting of Parliament, Kevin Rudd issued an apology to the Stolen Generation. Gary Foley at the time, an Aboriginal activist, described the apology, however, as, quote, yet another fraud in the long line of historically fraudulent acts and dishonest gestures that typify the Indigenous experience of all governments in Australian history. And I think the whole experience of the Rudd government since its apology demonstrates that in full. The apology served only as a fig leaf to cover the fact that the new government was continuing rather than breaking from the Howard agenda. Essential elements to remove Aborigines from their lands and to destroy communal land ownership has been prosecuted vigorously. And as if adding insult to injury, the government in, when it was April 2009, signed the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And as Chris Graham said for the National Indigenous Times, this was particularly ironic given the Labor government through the Northern Territory intervention was trashing that very, the very clauses of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples just as it put its pen to the paper. The intervention has undermined the gains of the 1976 Northern Territory Land Rights Act, and as John Pilger explained in the meeting, I think, a couple of days ago, that, after all, was the very purpose, to rip up land rights. So Labor's desire to run the system in, quote, the national interest, in this case the interest of the mining companies and the pastoralist bosses, means it has just as strong an interest in pursuing racist policies as have the Howard government. One of the things that particularly turned people against the Howard government was its treatment of refugees and asylum seekers. Labor made some minor changes to the Pacific Solution, shutting down the Nauru and Manus Island detention centres and abolishing temporary protection visas. But for the most part, it's continued the same racist policies. Mandatory detention has remained intact. Ashmore Reef and Christmas Island continue to be excised from Australia. Australia's refugee intake of 14,000 has been retained at the same levels as under the Howard government. The detention centres stay in private hands. And Rudd, of course, has diverted attention away from sympathy for the asylum seekers towards hostility to, quote, the people smugglers, describing them as the vilest form of human life who should rot in jail. Now, I suppose you might say it's a minor improvement on just attacking asylum seekers directly, but all this is a backdoor way of attacking asylum seekers in a form of guilt by association. And with the arrival of two boats, or with the interception, I should say, of two boats in October 2009, Rudd was able to demonstrate that the Pacific Solution continued under another name, in this case the Indonesian Solution, when the Rudd government basically rang up President Yudhoyono of Indonesia and asked him to take care and divert two boats heading for Australia back to Indonesia, where one of them actually still rots offshore, the people on board unable to access any asylum seekers' rights. Christmas Island is packing out. The UNHCR, the Human Rights Commission, High Commission of Refugees, describes conditions on Christmas Island as having all the characteristics of a medium security prison. One of the things that counted against the Howard government was children in detention centres. It's true, there are no children in the Christmas Island detention centre. However, there are 147 children right next door to the detention centre being kept under curfew and with barbed wire. And the Rudd government also promised to deal with asylum seekers' claims expeditiously and process them more quickly. However, it's still the case that 46 asylum seekers have been on detention centre in Christmas Island for more than a year. Labor is also as committed as the Howard government to the US war on terror. Rudd may have withdrawn combat troops from Iraq in 2008, but nonetheless has ramped up the war in Afghanistan, just as it promised. It regards Afghanistan as essentially the good war. And so when the US puppet government in Kabul began to face increasingly popular resistance in 2007, Rudd turned recruiting sergeant. Rudd showed up, oddly enough, at a NATO conference, given where Australia is not normally associated with the North Atlantic, the NATO conference Bucharest in 2008 to drum up support for troops to Afghanistan. And 1 year later, in April 2009, Rudd announced his own little surge of 450 military personnel to Afghanistan and a doubling of spending on occupation. Just as Israel was raining down bombs on the Palestinian people, Rudd was to be found frequently declaring his lifelong friendship for Israel. Julia Gillard visited Israel shortly after the war in Gaza to shake hands and slap backs with Israeli politicians, still with the blood fresh on their hands. And in 12th of March 2008, on the 60th anniversary of the foundation of the State of Israel, the catastrophe, as the Palestinians call it, the Rudd government moved a motion with bipartisan support to, quote, celebrate and commend the achievements of the State of Israel. And just as befitting, the 15th largest economy in the world, and in the face of rising tension between the US and China and the Pacific region, Rudd has announced a massive, unprecedented boost in military spending in peacetime, with a 21% increase in military spending in the current financial year, and the expenditure of money on 12 new submarines, 11 frigates and air force, it's a bit like the kind of 12 days of Christmas, 12 new submarines, 11 frigates and air warfare destroyers, and to spoil the rhythm, 100 new F-35 joint strike fighters. So this is Australian militarism on steroids, all part of the US alliance trying to secure the Pacific as a base for the US and Australian imperialism to dominate the region. Okay, so all of this, I think, should fairly clearly explain why the Rudd government enjoys the support of business. The Business Council of Australia President, Graham Bradley, announced just quite recently that, quote, there is considerable alignment between the Business Council's priorities and agenda and the government's priorities and agendas. The Australian, that well-known friend of workers' rights, Aborigines, refugees and so forth, has announced in January this year, Kevin Rudd as its Australian of the Year. And Labor has appointed the AIG, the Australian Industry Group, a prominent employer group, Heather Ridout, as essentially a cabinet member at large in Labor's consultation over changing tax policy and a range of other things. Now, Rudd may have denounced extreme capitalism, but he is frequently to be found in the company of some of the worst examples of this. Whether we're talking about Frank Lowy, the shopping mall billionaire, who he praised at some swanky dinner for his courage and resilience in building his business empire. This is when Frank Lowy's in the investigation in the United States for tax fraud, corrupt business practices and so forth. And of course, I'm sure we all share with Kevin Rudd his tears and his hand wringing as he lay with a tear-soaked handkerchief dabbing at his cheek as Dick Pratt lay dying in his bed in the Raheem Mansion in Toorak. Just as Dick Pratt was actually facing a trial for his cardboard box monopoly. Now, one of the reasons why the Rudd government's been able to get away with this has been the capitulation of the left of the Labor Party. Now, I don't have time to cite chapter and verse because I've been getting kind of wind-up calls from the chair here, but a whole series of left ministers have continued. I mean, you wouldn't know they were left ministers. They wouldn't know in any sense by anything they've said or anything they've done they stand in any sense in any political spectrum to the left of Rudd and Swan. So whether you're talking about Julia Gillard, who is responsible for maintaining the industrial police force. But you talk about Lindsay Tanner, who is, I mean, even within Labor's factional system, almost bizarrely, who would sit within the left, because on every economic question, which he's actually responsible for as finance minister, has a hard right-wing, dry economic agenda about tax cuts for rich and so forth. Martin Ferguson, like Julia Gillard from the soft left faction, bashed the unions in the run-up to the 2009 ALP National Conference for their criticisms of Labor's IR laws, and of course has been a keen advocate of the uranium industry. Kim Carr from the so-called hard left has been doling out billions of dollars in manufacturing industry subsidies. And Jenny Macklin, also from the hard left, has been responsible for Northern Territory intervention. But it's not just been the left ministers. It's not just been the ACTU, but a range of other forces. Some of the prime environmental groups, such as Australian Conservation Foundation, the World Wildlife Fund, actually supported Rudd's emissions trading scheme. We might look at other groups, some of the refugee groups, which were very late to criticise the Rudd government in the course of 2008 and 2009. You might look at the Greens, who were supposed to stand to the left of Labor, but have in fact been virtually mute as Labor attacks workers, students and refugees. Now, Rudd, it has to be said, is tolerated rather than loved within the working class. He may be loved by business, but he's only just tolerated within the working class. His popularity has been buoyed up by the government's apparent success in fending off the economic crisis. But nonetheless, it's also true that, particularly here in Melbourne, I suspect also in Perth, and quite obviously in the northwest Australia, where the Pluto LNG liquid natural gas processing site has been constructed, where workers kind of jeer and spit at the very names of Rudd and Gillard, union officials have been able to bash Rudd and Gillard verbally and receive warm rounds of applause as they do so. It's not the case that we're back in 1983-84, with the last time the Labor came into office, when basically Hawke was, you know, hardly the workers' hero, but nonetheless reasonably popular within the working class. And if any union official had tried criticising Hawke, he or she would have found opponents from the ranks of the workers ready to defend the new Prime Minister. So we have a very different kind of situation. The Rudd government is supported primarily by the capitalist class. It enjoys a degree of electoral support because of its apparent success in dodging the economic crisis, and therefore, so long as it has electoral support, grumblings and complaints within the ranks of the Labour Party, of which there are some, are basically held at bay because at last they've got someone who won them an election. So the situation now is that the Rudd government has essentially proved itself to business during the global financial crisis. A whole series of factors, both the result of government measures, but also some maybe happy coincidences, in particular Australia's role in providing commodities to China, the relatively resilient banking system, the fact that house prices haven't collapsed, has meant that Australian economy has ridden out the crisis better than most. Nonetheless, none of this absolves the government or ignores the fact that the Rudd government, whether from tax policy to industry policy, from foreign policy to Aboriginal rights, the Rudd government has pursued a right-wing agenda prioritising the rights of business. That is, after all, why he's been so popular with the business sector. And now, with Australia emerging from the global financial crisis, the government wants anxiously to return to budget surpluses and to cut spending to reassure the banks and the financial spivs and speculators that helped cause the crisis in the first place. Labor's working class supporters, who may have held out hope against hope, it should be said, in November 2007, that we would indeed be seeing an alternative echo, not an echo, that we would indeed see Labor taking a left-wing fork in the road, have only been left disappointed and betrayed by Labor in office.